On Tech News Today, we go inside the new Microsoft Surface Book laptop. Plus, Google's Street View app goes all virtual reality on us. And a company in Russia is now selling Vladimir Putin iPhones for some reason. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, October 7th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle. Would you like to get cash for your old iPhone? Gazelle makes it easy. Shipping is free and the payment is fast. What's your iPhone worth? Find out at gazelle.com. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace which connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/TNT to apply for a loan now. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is ZDNet contributing writer Kevin Toefel. Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I'm good, Mike. Glad to be here, especially the day after the big Microsoft press event where they came out with some pretty innovative stuff that I know we're going to talk about today.
We are, and we're in fact going to talk about the big laptop that they came out with. But this show is really, really heavy on changes to apps that many of us are using. So if you're into mobile apps, this is a great show for you. And, of course, Wednesday is always a great day for mobility because, of course, Kevin Toefel specializes in mobile computing. So let's jump right into that story. We told you yesterday about Microsoft's new Surface Book laptop, but one journalist, Mashable's Lance Yulinoff, got an inside look at the device and exactly how it was made. Lance joins us now. Welcome to the show, Lance.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. Now let's start with the most obvious feature of the Surface Book, the hinge. What's the deal with that hinge?
So they wanted to do something different. I sat down with Panos Panay, who's the new Windows new head of all devices, and Ralph Grohn, I think is the way you say his name, who's their chief creative guy or creative director. And they had this idea for a laptop, first and foremost. But they wanted to create this balance. So, you know, one, something that could come apart, but also balance in a way so it still looked like a laptop and still folded like a laptop. So that created a very sort of specific problem for them. And standard hinge wasn't going to do it. And they came up with this four-part hinge that basically what it fundamentally does is it extends the base. It extends the base out by kind of rolling out almost like a carpet and going forward. And I got to see the very earliest prototypes of this little design, which, by the way, they wouldn't tell me who's the guy, who's the mastermind behind the special hinge, but they started as plastic, and it just kind of became this really exquisitely designed thing that after a while, I think they started to get a little crazy about it, because once they figured it out and once it was going to be part of the Surface Book, then they wanted to show it off in a way. And Panos talked about this thing called a KISS, which at first when he started talking about this, I really had no idea where he was going with it. It was very strange.
Sounds very uncomfortable.
but basically, and I did notice it, but I didn't put it all together. When I was holding the Surface Book, I noticed on the outside edge, each of the four pieces of metal, it's all magnesium, seemed shiny, almost like I thought there was plastic on them, quite honestly. It turns out that's the KISS, this little bit of elegance. And they wanted to show the precision in a way that's a very sort of Apple-like conversation. And, you know, the more I talked to these guys, the two of them, and more in particular Panos, I was seeing a passion for bringing products to market that didn't necessarily exist at Microsoft for a long time. Not at this level, but you know, it feels like a different place, and this is certainly a different kind of product for them.
Well, KISS or no KISS, Lance, I do think the hinge is pretty innovative. I'd like to see this coming out of Microsoft. It does, as you said, extend the footprint of the device, which makes it more lappable, which I like.
Let's talk about lappability.
There you go. Let's talk about the actual two pieces of it, the base and the tablet, because, well, I say tablet because the screen pulls off, but they're calling it a clipboard. It does not have a hinged back like the Surface Pro does, so it is more of a slate than anything else. But the base, it seems, is heavier, and that makes sense to me because you don't want this tippable. You want it lappable and not tippable. You want it stable. But I'm a little concerned about, it seems like most of the battery bits are in the base of this and that the clipboard or tablet piece is lighter because it has less battery inside. And I'm hearing, and maybe you can confirm, that the tablet bit or the clipboard only gets about 3 hours of battery life. What have you heard on that?
Right. Well, at the event, they actually told me that it was, I think it was 3 to 4 top and roughly 8 on the base. So there is more battery in the base. The base is designed to be heavier, but not a lot heavier. You know, it's a bit of a balancing act here because they did it, you know, you're not designing, and this is why they had to do that special thing with the base. You're not simply designing a screen. You're designing a full-blown computer that's attached to a base that actually also adds some computing power because, as I talked about on the launch, there is a GPU, a discrete GPU in the base of the device. So when you put it all together, you gain the benefit of that. But yeah, the idea of having it balance, being lappable, and balance was of critical importance. I talked a lot about that in my discussion with them about figuring out the design, figuring out the weight, and also figuring out, you know, I want to back up for 1 second because one thing to keep in mind here is that, yes, there's less battery life on the tablet, but they told me that they expect that 80% of the time this will be used as a laptop. And then the 20%, it'll be detached for some, you know, for something else. But a lot of times you may use it. You know, you can detach the screen, flip it around and put it back in, and then you close the device. So now the screen is on the outside and it's sort of this sketchbook mode, which they expect a lot of people to use. So that's which, again, gives it more power, too. So there's that as well. I'm trying to remember what else I was going to say about it. There's a lot of it's so much new technology for Microsoft that. You know, initially, you know, since we didn't expect this at all, there were no leaks. They told me they gave people access to the final product about a week and a half before yesterday's event. So one of the reasons no one knew this was coming. So it really caught us all by surprise. So it was certainly a lot to ingest.
Lance, years ago, I think it was like 6 years ago, Microsoft had a prototype device called the Courier.
And you bring that up.
And it was a new type of tablet, and it was if I recall, it had two screens on it. Yes. It was kind of a book like thing. This device is called the Book. Did they tell you why they have the name Book, the word Book, in the title of this device?
Well, from the earliest days of designing it, almost 2 years ago. Panos was sort of saying, let's make the ultimate laptop, but let's like think of it like a book so people can hold it like a book, sort of carry it about that way. You know, you notice when you close it, instead of it being this flat slab, right, it's actually opened at sort of toward the hinge like that. So it has this unusual gap. I kind of pressed them a little bit on this because I was a little concerned about the gap being not strong enough. You know, would it open it up to more issues? But they said they've tested it and, you know, it's strong as any laptop out there. But it does create that look. It, more than anything, it creates that look of a book. And, of course, then they use the metaphor of they don't call the top a tablet. They call it a clipboard. You know, you remove the clipboard. So, you know, there's all these sort of, you know, things that they've done to sort of try and suggest to you how you should think about it. And they've done things, too, that Microsoft's paid a lot of attention to sort of how you feel about the Surface Book and how it makes you feel when you use it. So one really good example is what happens when you detach the screen. First of all, it won't just detach by pulling it off. So I have a Surface. I'm actually doing our call right now on a Surface Pro 3. And that you just pull apart from the keyboard. But the Surface Book, if you tried to do that, it wouldn't come apart. There's a dedicated button. When you hit that dedicated button, you hold it down for about 2 seconds, which I think is a slight learning curve, not a big one. But you actually hear something. You hear like this click, and then you just lift the screen out. But what they told me is the click is like a fake. there is no click.
Wow.
The technology that's used to unlock it doesn't actually make a sound. So they added a sound.
Wow.
They added something to sort of give you the so-called confidence that it is ready to be removed or fully inserted.
So if Microsoft assumes correctly that 80% of this time this will be used as a laptop, it's mm-hmm. obvious that it needs a good keyboard, good trackpad on that base. And I use a Surface Pro 3 as well, and I'm actually pretty happy with the Type cover, not so much with the trackpad on it right now. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit larger, and it looks nicer. Have you gotten a chance to actually type on it, use the trackpad? And if so, what did you think?
Very briefly at the event, great action on the keyboard. The keys are separated, they're great size. It feels full size. It's 13-inch laptop, so you've got all the space, and they definitely use it well for the trackpad. But always with trackpads, you need a lot of time with them to really know whether or not they're going to be good. I've had some terrible ones, and I've had some great ones, and from all the major manufacturers, with the exception of Apple, which has always done, honestly, a really good job with them. But it certainly looks bigger and better, so I'm hopeful.
Lance, I promised to get you off in 5 minutes, and I really apologize. We went longer than that, but this is just so fascinating. And if I could impose on you one last compound question, which is, number one, do you want to buy one? And number two, is Microsoft back? Is this going to put Microsoft back on the map as a major player in the business, I guess?
Well, it's definitely too early to say whether or not I want to buy one. I will tell you that as somebody who uses a Surface Pro 3 every single day, I have a decision to make. Am I someone who wants the upgrade, the Surface Pro 4, or am I somebody who's going to switch to the Surface Book? Now, the Surface Pro 4 is still going to be lighter, I think, in total than the Surface Book. But the Surface Book has, I think, potentially more power. It's elegant. It's beautiful to look at. They both have touch screens, which I believe I really like and I want, and they both have the great pens. I don't know, but it's a great, and I think that's something that Panos said to me yesterday, that he thinks is a great problem for his customers to have. As far as the company being back, I think Microsoft is in a very interesting place right now. It is able to do sort of hide in plain sight. Every time they do something like the Surface Book or the HoloLens, where they actually surprise us, people are like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. How are they keeping secrets when no one else, including Apple, can anymore? Because no one's paying attention. Because people still believe that Microsoft is somebody who is not innovating, who is not breaking new ground, who is not leading. But if you've been paying attention over the last 2 years, what you have seen is that Microsoft is leading in a key area, and that is in the computing, the laptop computing space. How many knockoffs are we seeing of the Surface Pro 3? How many companies suddenly, like Google and even Apple, are introducing things we never thought they would? Apple has a keyboard. Apple has a pen. Apple puts them together and shows you the iPad Pro. That is something that Microsoft hasn't led in a very long time. I think they feel that. They sense it. And I don't think Microsoft ever went away. I've had this argument with many people. There are 300 million people out there using Windows, probably nearly that many using Office. They have a great business. They make a lot of money. But they're finally doing something that they probably never quite did before, truly putting the hardware and software together in a way that makes something different and that people actually want.
Wonderful. Lance Ulanoff is at Mashable.com and on Twitter at Lance Ulanoff. Lance, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Bye, guys.
We got more news coming right up, but first I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is one of our sponsors today, and Gazelle is out to save the environment. What am I talking about? Well, smartphones, unfortunately, this is the bad news, are horrible for the environment. The manufacturing process is incredibly bad for the environment. There's all kinds of toxic elements that go into it. There's a lot of waste involved in building a smartphone. And really, the there are a few companies that try to make environmentally friendly smartphones, but they're really not. They have to have batteries. They have to have lots of ingredients inside those phones that are toxic and problematic. So really, the only environmentally friendly smartphone is one that is never manufactured. So if you participate in the reselling and reuse of smartphones by using Gazelle, you're helping the environment. You're instead of having you have a smartphone in a drawer or in a box or in your garage, and somebody else going out there and buying a new phone, you can put your phone into circulation. They'll buy your old phone instead of buying a new phone. And the more people who participate in Gazelle, the fewer phones have to be manufactured. Think about that. This is a really, really easy and appealing way to help the environment in some small way. Simply go to Gazelle and buy a smartphone from Gazelle, or sell your smartphone to Gazelle, or both. And get everybody else to participate in this aspect of helping the environment, because, of course, the other benefit is you get the latest and greatest phone. You don't have to hold on to your phone forever thinking that it's wasteful to upgrade to a new phone. No, it's wasteful to not use a phone. No matter who is involved, if you're not using it, that's wasteful. So get it back into circulation, and Gazelle will find a happy home for your device, and they will sell you a newish device at a fraction of the price of a brand new device. So you got to go to Gazelle and check it out. Even if you're just on the fence, even if you don't have a device right now to sell, or even if you're not in the market for buying one, go to Gazelle right now, GAZELLE.com, and check it out. Trade in your used phone and electronics for cash. Visit Gazelle.com today. Google today unveiled a new initiative for speeding up websites on smartphones. It's called Accelerated Mobile Pages, or AMP. And it's seen as an open-source alternative to Facebook's instant articles. Aaron Griffith writes for Fortune and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Now, how does AMP work? I think we know a lot about Facebook instant articles and how that works. How does this work?
The interesting thing about AMP is it's a little bit more complicated than Facebook's instant articles. And I think there were a lot of questions that weren't answered or maybe weren't answered all that clearly at today's press event. But it is essentially open sourced. So anybody can plug this code that Google has written into their own web pages, and then they will automatically have these beautiful, fast loading sites that work really well on mobile. And that's sort of that's basically the idea behind it. There's a lot of kind of questions like, where does this content actually live and what's standard and what's not? But right now, Google only pitched it as a demo. So, they're saying there's a lot to be worked out. It's not live yet, only through a few different links. But they do have a lot of publishers that have already, as you can see here, signed up and are trying it out.
So, Aaron, mobile ads are actually a pretty hot topic right now, particularly with iOS 9 and content blockers and such. And it's no surprise that Google makes most of its revenue from ads. That's not, a newsflash there. But, is this going to be exclusive for pages that only use Google's ad network, so it will help Google? Or is it actually open for any potential ad network to be shown on these mobile or accelerated mobile pages?
No, it's open, I think, for any ad network. I think Google wants basically to create some sort of standard for ads that kind of avoid the really annoying takeover ads, the kind of ads that ad blockers are designed to block, the ones that people actually really hate. But obviously, Google is very pro ad. And so this is kind of a stake in the ground. Like, we can make the mobile browsing experience better without completely killing ads, like a lot of people on iOS are now doing with their ad blockers.
Now, the early reports on this, which were based on anonymous sources, they frame this as Google partnering with Twitter. Is that what actually came about? Is that what they announced? Is Twitter involved in this?
Twitter is involved in this. They were one of the four, I think, or five publishers that were up on stage at the event today. But Twitter's not the only platform or sort of like, news not the only company that's not an actual publisher that's involved. You know, there are people from Parsley there. There are people from Chartbeat there. There are people from Nuzzle there, which are all, you know, sort of tech companies that are around the news category, but not actually news producers themselves. So I think there's a lot of ways into this from a lot of different companies. And Twitter, as you know, also launched their own news product on Monday, which has human curation of tweets. It's called Moments. It's a separate tab inside the Twitter app. So, I mean, this is basically a way for anyone who has a news app to allow news pages and articles to load even faster within their own app. So I don't think that it's an exclusive deal with Twitter, and I don't think Twitter is the only publisher that's or the only platform that's going to be using this technology. You know, like many Google things, it's meant to be open source. It's meant to be open for everyone. I believe they mentioned that WordPress is also developing a plugin now. So that way, basically, anybody who publishes on WordPress can just kind of download this plugin, and their pages are already, you know, AMP compatible. So it sounds like this is something that Google wants everybody to be using. But it is a play against Facebook and Apple's kind of walled garden, especially Facebook, which is pulling a lot of content into Facebook, and that means it's not Googleable. That means it's not monetizable with Google search ads. So the more open, the better for Google.
Yeah, Google has a history of, you know, trying to make things better, particularly when it's web related, you know, when they see opportunities here, whether people like it or not. And this one strikes me as another one. And I'm curious, Aaron, do you think this is Google saying, all right, publishers and app makers, you've pretty much given us a really crappy experience. So we're just going to take over and try this now because we know the best way to do this. Do you think they're kind of sticking it to these guys?
You know, that's an interesting question, and you might be right there. And, you know, actually, I saw Om Malik tweeted something today that this is just publishers, you know, further highlighting how they've given up on trying to be innovative and trying to solve these technical problems themselves and just kind of handed it over to the big tech platforms. And in a way, he's right, because a lot of media companies just aren't innovative, especially on the tech side. They've never really been able to figure out how to get their CMS is right. And now, you know, on the mobile web, they're already behind there too. But the one counter to that is that, you know, it's not just legacy media companies that are involved in this. They're, you know, they had people on stage today from Vox and BuzzFeed, and those are both companies that are now valued like tech companies. You know, they're valued in the billions of dollars, and a big part of that is because of their technology prowess, because their home-baked CMSs and their, you know, abilities to publish on multiple platforms. So I don't think that this is just for, you know, legacy media companies that can't figure out the tech. It seems like everyone's kind of experimenting with this multi-platform distribution system, and I think that's definitely going to be the way that we're going forward with publishing.
Well, fast internet is always good. I hope that this at least does that, and we'll see who gets on board. Aaron Griffith is at fortune.com and on Twitter at Aaron Griffith. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Right. ProPublica reported yesterday that Verizon plans to combine the personal information it collects on users with the details harvested by AOL's ad network. Jeff Larson co-authored the piece for ProPublica, and he joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hi, Mike.
Now, how does this tracking work exactly? There's a lot of tracking going on here, and so this is an interesting story because this is everybody's nightmare of when, you know, disparate databases on users come together and can be used in combination. Now, how does this tracking work exactly?
So Verizon and other telecoms insert what's known as a HTTP header into HTTP traffic that is unencrypted. And what advertising companies have been able to do in the past is link those unique headers into an HTTP request with demographic data. So in the past, we found Turn, an advertising company. We also found that Twitter was doing a similar sort of thing for their partners. What's new here is Verizon and AT&T got a lot of heat for practicing this sort of header injection. And now what Verizon is saying that they're doing is they're going to merge users' tracking behavior with AOL's online ad tracking network, as well as Verizon's offline billing data, so that they get a deeper profile of folks traveling around the internet.
Jeff, you mentioned that that some of this data is actually unencrypted, which is obviously a privacy nightmare for people who care. Does Verizon even allow for an opt-out? Because I think when they first started this whole super cookie thing, they didn't allow that. And I'm curious if they're giving that option to users with this new approach with AOL.
Part of the news here is that they are allowing you to opt out. By default, the program is opt-in, however, and I don't believe that, you know, folks will take the time out of their busy lives to sort of opt out into this sort of tracking. The other thing about the unencrypted part, so Verizon is sending down this header that rotates periodically, so it's not the same unique header all the time. And basically, if you're one of the companies in the know, like AOL, then you can use that to join it with your profiles. And this is a boon to advertisers because in the past they've had problems tracking people using, like, say, Safari on their iPhone and then switching over to Tweetbot. Now, and using the web view inside there, the little web browser inside of their Twitter client, now they can track people's viewing habits on you know, Safari and across apps and things like that. And advertisers have been trying to figure that out for a long time, and this seems to be, you know, the key to that lock.
I don't think most people really know which ad networks are serving up the ads that they see online. Can you give us a sense of how widely used AOL's ad network is, and for that matter, how many customers Verizon has, just to get a sense of how widespread this problem is?
Sure. So AOL is AOL's ad network reaches 40% of the internet, and Verizon has 137 million customers. When we wrote about, when we approached Verizon to comment on this story, they said that this is, you know, it's their chief privacy officer told us that it's better because it's, all of this stuff is inside one company. But when you're talking about 137 million users and 40% of the internet, that's a pretty wide swath of users that they now can target based on their interests and their age and their gender.
We'll see if this actually makes anything like advertising more relevant somewhere for someone. Jeff Larson is at ProPublica.org and on Twitter at TheJeffLarson. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike. Have a good one.
All right, bye-bye. Facebook is partnering with the on-demand service Pro.com to enable home repairs to be arranged via Facebook Messenger. Carolyn O'Donovan is a senior technology reporter for BuzzFeed News and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
Hello, hello.
Now, how does this feature work exactly?
The idea is just that if you wanted to book a service with someone from Pro.com, you could either send a text message. It's actually, the service is called Text to Pro. So if you wanted to book someone, you could text them, or you could use Facebook Messenger and say, you know, I just bought this new TV. I need it installed on my wall. Do you have someone who can come by? Someone who works in Seattle and is employed by Pro.com would talk to you over SMS or over Facebook Messenger, whatever you prefer, and then they would help you figure out who you want to work with, when that person can come by your house. And an interesting point, I think, when we're thinking about this kind of thing is that it's also set at a flat rate. So it's not the kind of experience where someone comes to your house, they do a service, and then you have this debate over what it should have cost. You pay them by the hour. It's sort of commoditized by the fact that it's a flat rate. So you agree ahead of time on what it's going to cost, and then that's kind of it.
Carolyn, it's an interesting partnership because I would imagine it expands the reach of Pro.com potential customers, Facebook having, say, a billion people using it. It seems like there's a bit of, I don't want to say consolidation, but a lot of these partnerships starting to take place. I think TaskRabbit recently signed an agreement with another major web company in the recent past. And I'm wondering, you know, is that what's happening in this industry? People who offer services and web web availability of things, are they going to continue to try and partner with these large groups like Facebook?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think it helps to think, imagine it as a supply and demand problem. So like you have on the one hand, all of these people who are using Google search or are using Amazon, and then you have all of these people who want to get paid to fix your clogged sink. So it's a matter of always keeping in balance those two sides. So TaskRabbit has a partnership with Amazon Home Services, the idea being that if you are on Amazon, right, and you buy a TV, like I said before, and you need it to be installed, you can find someone on TaskRabbit in your area who would be then available to come by and install it for you without ever having to leave Amazon. And that kind of, the idea is that it helps the supply and demand meet in the middle. So this is a similar partnership, like you said. Pro.com has this network of hundreds of thousands of service professionals. There are, like you said, a lot of people who use Facebook Messenger who are more comfortable texting. I think Mark Zuckerberg said at the big FA conference in San Francisco this spring, people don't actually enjoy calling, making telephone calls that they don't have to make. Increasingly, they would much rather do something over the phone if they can. And I'm obviously with, you know, companies like Uber, we know that to be true. So this is a way of sort of capturing all those people. You might be pushing off having to call a plumber, going to Yelp, picking out someone. This makes it a little bit easier and almost puts the burden of some of that connective work on someone who already works for Pro.com. So yes, it's definitely about matching people who need a service completed and who are using these platforms already with people who are waiting to get booked for them, but might be hard to find otherwise.
You know, I'm curious about a weird phenomenon that exists. It's a psychological phenomenon that exists in the on-demand economy. I think people used to rack their brains to make sure they got the right skilled handyman, if you will, to come to their house. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, which one should we get? We don't want to get the wrong one. And in the on-demand economy, people suddenly are just like, well, whoever they send is fine, whatever. It's just easy. But barring that, do you think that this that a messaging app is really the most compelling way to arrange these kinds of services? I mean, personally, do you think that people are going to jump on this?
Yeah. So I think what you're talking about is what people usually call the trust issue. How do you know that you've booked the right person, that the person's going to come, and blah, blah, blah. So a couple of these platforms, Porch.com is one of them, Pro.com, I know that's confusing, is another. First of all, there's a certification. There's, you know, they have to go through certain steps before they're actually going to send someone to your house to make sure that they're not, you know, that they're reliable. But those two companies also offer guarantees. So if the person comes and they can't figure it out, or they don't have the appropriate equipment, it's not completed in the amount of time that you thought it was going to be, someone else has to come back. Instead of the way you'd usually have to negotiate that if you were booking someone off of Yelp or Yellow Pages or something along those lines, they will actually guarantee the cost of the service. So if they have to send someone else out another time, there are different arrangements on each site. Pro.com is a little bit different than what Porch just rolled out with their new guarantee, but they will actually pay for the job to be completed because they want you to be a return customer. They don't want you to have a frustrating experience and then not want to use the site again. So it's in their interest, right, to sort of make sure that your first or second time is valuable and that you get what you needed to have. So I think that kind of addresses a little bit of that problem of, is it just a random person? I mean, it is and it isn't, right? Like TaskRabbit, for example, has very in-depth profiles. And I've talked to people who work off of that platform that say, the more effort you put into building that profile, having a good picture, being very specific about your experience, you know, you don't want to exaggerate your skill set and then come to someone's home and be unable to do a task. I think that there are different ways across platforms that people address the trust issue. And I mean, on the sort of outskirts of what's possible, I've heard multiple times people talk about the idea of taking something like an Uber rating that a driver might have. And is there a way that we can turn that into a worker rating that applies to different platforms? If you're thinking about people who are maybe driving on Uber and Lyft and for Postmates or something like that. And that's when I think you start to really get into an interesting and maybe trepidatious area about what it means to create a sort of digital metric for trust. I mean, and then you push that out to, there's all been this controversy this week about the People app, right, where you actually just rate people for how they are. So I think all of that conversation, which is across a really broad spectrum, is about dealing with what you're talking about, which is about meeting a stranger off of the internet, which has always been scary.
Well, surely this will expand the potential reach for Pro.com, but there's a whole other side to this that I'm wondering about. Facebook is obviously doing the matching, and it's got all that information of who's actually taking part in Pro.com services as a result of that. So I'm wondering, do we know if I go through Facebook to Pro.com and have my kitchen remodeled by somebody, am I going to start seeing sponsored posts and ads for, say, kitchen appliances?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I didn't actually get to talk to Facebook yet about the product, but it's definitely true that the company is getting more interested in not necessarily owning some of that data. I mean, I think they've been pretty specific about, especially recently, about their feelings about privacy in terms of what you search for and who you talk to. But I mean, they certainly have the automated M personal assistant that they've been working on. They have Facebook at Work. So they're definitely, in terms of how much they know about you, I think sort of spreading their tentacles out a bit into different areas of your life. But I mean, it's always been a highly personal platform, right? So but I think that the question you ask about advertising is interesting, because the way Google plays in this space is, in fact, an advertising play, right? So I think it's definitely valuable to think about.
All right. Carolyn O'Donovan is at BuzzFeed.com. And you can find her on Twitter at CEO Donovan. Are you a CEO, Carolyn?
I am not a CEO, but I would say it's more than a coincidence that my parents chose that those particular set of initials.
Awesome. CEO Donovan on Twitter. All right, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
We told you Thursday about an iOS app called Speed Camera Alert, which tells drivers in Washington, D.C. when they're near a speed camera. The app was based on information published by the D.C. Police Department, and the app developer created an online petition to get it reinstated. Well, now Apple has done that, and the app is now available again in the App Store. Kevin Toefel, I wrote a column about this, eviscerating Apple for this, that was published Monday. And I'm going to pretend like they listened to me and made the change because of what I wrote.
So everybody can thank Mike because Apple finally came to their senses.
You're all welcome. And,
yeah, you know, we talked about this on the show last week and how Apple said it was not providing legal information in that particular district or jurisdiction, when in fact in Washington, D.C., it is, you know, legal and available information. So, again, this was, we talked about if this was a play between the big developer versus the small developer, because Google has ways and, you know, I'm just glad Apple came to their senses and turned this over and put it back in circulation.
So am I. It's a great thought. And when I was writing this column, I was thinking more about what it is that Apple was doing. And in fact, the publishing of this data, you know, this is essentially the simple overlaying of publicly available data that was published by the police department into a Maps application to actually make it safer to interact with that data while you're driving. You wouldn't want to actually just look at the list and say, am I on this corner? This data was published as the result of a democratic process. They weren't intending to create speed traps. They wanted to be open about where the cameras were. And so this information is in the hands of the public, and it's their right to use it. And so I'm so glad that Apple changed their mind, and we'll see if they do something about the ban on that drone app that tells you about drone strikes that kill people in other countries. They still, to the best of my knowledge, have banned that. Well, another story in product update news. Facebook has added the ability to draw on photos, a feature that already existed in its Messenger app. The feature is called Doodle, and it's been added to the edit tools for the iOS and Android Facebook apps. This should result, Kevin Toefel, in some very tasteful photographs. Not.
Define tasteful. I'm sure my kids will actually love this because they like to, you know, draw and doodle on photos of their friends and whatnot. And they use the new Snapchat filters and so on. Me personally, I'm not a doodler, so I won't get any value out of this one.
Yeah, I think the only way that I would use this, the only purpose that I would use this for, is for drawing a red circle around something I want to bring attention to. So it's, I guess, useful for that. If you really like to do it. Sometimes that's actually really funny when you like circle something and really isolate that item. Well, Google announced yesterday an improvement to Android Marshmallow that enables Google Translate to work inside apps. Now, the apps need to be updated to support the feature, so it's not going to work in everything all the time. But once updated, you can select text inside an app, which will pop up a translation option. I think we're getting to a world, Kevin, where language differences will become mostly irrelevant when we're using, you know, our technology.
Yeah, language barriers have kind of been crumbling down thanks to the internet and mobile apps and so on. This is great to see. And as you said, apps actually have to be updated to take advantage of this. And on top of that, they have to be running on Android 6.0 or Marshmallow, which currently is only available for a select few Google Nexus devices. I'm trying to get it on my Nexus 6 as we speak. So this isn't something people can rush out and go try, but it is definitely something to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another Google product update news. Google's standalone Street View app for Android now supports Google Cardboard. So you can look around inside Street View by basically looking around inside Street View. This is really cool, Kevin Toefel, because, of course, you know, every Street View photo is really a 360 photo. I mean, it's why not?
Yeah, Street View is made for this type of VR approach. And I'm such a dummy. 2 years ago at Google I.O., they handed out Cardboard for the first time. And yeah. I was in a rush. And I'm like, that's a piece of Cardboard. I'm going to leave. And I never got it. And now I have to go spend $20, $30 and go get some Cardboard because they're doing some great things. And I use Street View all the time just to see different areas around the world that I may not ever get to. So to see it in the Cardboard app would be awesome.
Absolutely. Well, but folks, don't do it while driving. It's not a good idea. Well, we got some more news coming right up. But first, let's talk about Prosper, one of our sponsors today. Prosper is the way to borrow money these days. You don't want to borrow money from a bank. You don't want to borrow it from a friend or a relative. You want to borrow it from Prosper, and I'm going to tell you why. It's the internet way to borrow money. You simply go to prosper.com and you fill out basically a form. You know, what's your name? All the, you know, a few details which are kept private and secure by Prosper. And then somebody comes along and invests in your project. For example, you want to remodel your kitchen. You can get a loan for that. You want to pay off your high-rate credit card debt. You can get a loan for that. You can get a green loan, which means you're going to make something more environmentally friendly. You know, you're going to get rid of your Volkswagen, for example. You can get a loan for that. It's a green loan. There are lots of people out there that want to back and invest in environmentally friendly projects. By far the biggest use for Prosper, though, appears to be getting out of that, you know, sort of changing the debt from high interest rate credit card debt to low interest rate loan from Prosper. It's a stable amount that you pay each month. It comes right out of your account. There's no penalty for early payment. So it's a great loan in its own right. It's a great investment for the investors, and it's a great way to borrow money. You've got to check out Prosper.com. And, you know, one of the things you can do also is go there and just see the experience of other people, see what other people are doing. It's essentially a kind of a, it's almost like a social network for people who are doing interesting projects, if you look at it that way. So it's a very, very cool way to borrow money for up to $35,000 in your account in as few as 5 days. Just go to prosper.com/TNT. And we thank Prosper for their support of Tech News Today. That's prosper.com/TNT. Well, the news you can lose, I've got some great news for you iPhone enthusiasts who are also fans of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who turns 63 today. Today's his birthday. A Russian jewelry company called Caviar is now taking orders for a special iPhone 6S called the Gold Supreme Putin Anniversary iPhone. It's got Putin's face on the back, raised in gold, surrounded by titanium, and the price is around $3,200, and it comes with a free box. Caviar is selling 63 of these limited edition phones, so act now. Kevin Toefel, I bet you can't wait to get one of these.
You know, I think it's a great idea, actually. I just don't have the $3,200, so instead I just put them on my lock
screen. Nice, nice. Yeah. That's beautiful. That's the cheap way. And I hope they come out with a Donald Trump phone. I would jump on that in just a second.
You can have a case with hair on it and all.
Exactly. Yeah. Wouldn't that be great? Well, our TNT fan of the day is Trenton Moody, who posted this picture on Twitter. He says he listens to Tech News Today while working the night shift, apparently in some kind of store. Very cool. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. And use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Kevin Toefel, what are you working on these days? Are you working on that? You're sifting through the aftermath of the big Microsoft announcement?
I am indeed. Actually, first, I'm going to remove that lock screen because I just did that while you were telling the story. So last week, I had said I was going to try and use my iPad as a full-time device for writing and fun and games and all because the iPad Pro is coming. Well, yeah, Microsoft really put a wrench in my decision-making process because the Surface Pro 4 is attractive, as is the Surface Book. But as I said to Lance earlier, I'm a little concerned about that three-hour battery life on the clipboard because I tend to use my devices, you know, half laptops during the day and half tablets. Not 3 hours is not going to cut it for me.
Yeah, tablets tend to have really long battery lives, and that's one of the advantages of doing what you were doing, which is, you know, using an iPhone or rather an iPad as a full-time computer, because it's like the battery life is amazing. So, by the way, how is that going so far? Have you been doing that all week using the iPad?
I have, and it's definitely, I've had to adjust my workflow because obviously with no keyboard or mouse support, I'm sorry, no mouse or trackpad support, you got to reach out a lot on an iPad. I mean, you write, Mike, so you know that in a content management system, there's typically lots of different fields to fill out, and sometimes I can tab to them, sometimes I can't, so I've got to tap them, and then there's dropdowns, and I've got to tap the dropdowns, so it's a little frustrating from that regard, but I think I can make it work. I'm actually using Byword, an iOS app, to do my writing, and then I go in and fill in all my fields, and it's working well. I think I'll do better on the larger display of the iPad Pro, which will have the full multi-view split screen support as well.
Well, now that Apple is going to be making a keyboard that is designed to work with an iPad, I hope they just use the regular keystrokes that exist in OS X. I mean, it's very often I do just, you know, I just habitually do keystrokes, and I just think, well, why don't they just implement that? You know?
They do have some shortcuts. Even now, as I use an Apple Bluetooth wireless keyboard, I can use various keyboard shortcuts. And you can actually, with iOS 9, use two fingers on the software keyboard as a trackpad. The problem is that when you're using a hardware keyboard, that's not always visible. And even if it is, you're like reaching out. I don't mean to poke everybody in the eye, but you're reaching out to the screen to actually mouse around. So
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for co-anchoring today, and we'll see you next week.
Sounds great, Mike. Thanks.
Right. Bye-bye. Let us know what's on your mind. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or call us at 260-TNT-SHOW. That's 260-868-7469. You can leave a message. Nobody's going to answer that phone, but you can leave a message and we might play it on the air. You can subscribe to Tech News Today by going to twit.tv/TNT. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT, as I said, and what you'll find there is you're going to find all kinds of options to download every single episode. You can search for old episodes. There's a lot of stuff going on this page, so check out twit.tv/TNT. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you do it. Just post a link to, you guessed it, twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice, tag three friends, and recommend that they subscribe. You can also subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com, and you can follow me at elgin.com. Don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Kleanthis and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you tomorrow.